You're listening to Building Bridges. I'm Ken Nash.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg. We're Building Bridges. I am enormously pleased to have Paul Ortiz, a historian, professor of history at the University of Florida, and is director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. The books that he's authored have really informed me, Remembering Jim Crow, Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida from Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920, and African American and Latinx History of the United States, which details North American history from a Latinx and African American perspective, one that has been severely underrepresented. Professor Ortiz, I wanted to ask you to speak about your perspective about the Latinx experience in America and how it helps us understand the experience of various groups of Latinx peoples during this time of COVID-19 with the rise of militia violence, policing in communities, along the border, the terror campaigns from ICE, and the slander and incendiary fanning of the flames by the federal administration for white supremacy and white nationalism.
Yes.
Give us your understanding of concerns of the Latinx communities. And, of course, it's a very diverse and broad community from Latin America to Puerto Rico and Mexico, et cetera.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the program. So one of the things is a big question, but as a historian, I like to kind of dial us back to the year 1813. If you can kind of like put on our historical thinking caps, it's the middle of the Mexican War of Independence. With the exception of the Haitian Revolution, the Mexican War of Independence is the most important revolution in this hemisphere. It's the most important because it begins with the idea of the abolition of slavery. Most of the soldiers who fought against the Spanish Empire in what's now Mexico, which was New Spain, of course, most of those soldiers were former enslaved Africans. They were indigenous people. They were mestizos. They were mixes of Spanish, European, and indigenous peoples. When we think about indigenous people's histories in the context of Latinx histories, that's a very important consideration in and of itself. As Latinos, as Hispanos, Mexicanos, Chicanos, whatever we call ourselves, we have roots in three great traditions. First, the indigenous traditions of the Americas. Our peoples go back many, many, many millennia from a diversity of cultural and religious and historic experiences. It's important to understand we had a history long before the Europeans arrived in this hemisphere. Another root, and if you think of this in the context of Mexican history, the nation of Mexico now recognizes three great roots of the nation. So the indigenous root, the so-called pre-Columbian root, right? The African root, because we're also African in origin. My great-grandmother, by the way, was a curandera. What that means is she was a powerful shaman in her community. Our community, you know, working class Houston community during my father's day in the 1940s and 50s, we didn't have doctors. We didn't have any kinds of resources, you know, helping us out. And so we had my great-grandmother. And in her shaman kind of religious spiritual practice, she combined these three traditions, indigenous, African, and European, and combined all three of them together, right? So we're a mix of those great traditions. But the reason I wanted us to think about 1813 in the context of your question is, it's the middle of the Mexican War of Independence. It's a struggle for independence that includes the struggle against slavery and the struggle against indigenous oppression. All of the issues that you talked about, police brutality, xenophobia, border oppression, are manifest in 1813. The first iteration of the Mexican Constitution was in 1813, and it's formulated on the field of battle, essentially. The soldiers who are fighting, and again, remember, these are former enslaved Africans. These are indigenous people. These are mestizos, mixes of European and indigenous and African peoples. The first thing they say is, we want an end to slavery and discrimination based upon caste, right? Because the Spanish had a rigid caste system, how it divided us by our race and ethnicity. Another point was, torture shall not be permitted. You know, this is really the origins of police brutality. It originates in Spanish imperialism, British, French imperialism, all of these European imperialisms begin with terror and torture. That's how they steal the land from indigenous people. They don't ask for permission. They don't pay indigenous people for their land. They don't pay African slaves to work for them. Instead, Europeans use torture and terror to get all of these things out of indigenous and African descent peoples. So I think 1813 and the Mexican War of Independence, whether you're a Mexican or Puerto Rican or Dominican or whatever, that's the key year for all of us. And I also want to, you know, one more addition there is the Haitian Revolution. That's the most important revolution of all in the history of this hemisphere. The reason it's the most important is it's the Haitian Revolution which sets the stage for the abolition of slavery, one. Two, for all of the independent struggles of all of the nations that you mentioned in your opening statement. The Great Liberator, Simón Bolívar, Antonio Maceo, José Martí, Maximo Gómez, the list goes on and on. Freedom fighters from Latin America all find their way to Haiti at a certain point because the Haitians defeated three major European armies en route to declaring independence and the abolition of slavery in Haiti. They defeated the French twice. They defeated the British. They defeated the Spanish imperial armies. Those of us with ancestors from Latin America or the Caribbean or North America, frankly, all end up turning to the Haitians really from 1804 on for tactics, for ideas. How do we defeat imperialism? How do we end slavery in Venezuela, in Mexico, in North America? Haiti becomes a beacon of liberty for oppressed people. But for the tyrants, for the oppressors, like Alexander Hamilton, like Thomas Jefferson, Haiti becomes what they call a contagion of liberty. And Hamilton and Jefferson and Washington and all of his friends, so-called founding fathers, they look at Haiti with terror. They look at Mexico with terror because these are nations doing it right. They're actually starting independent struggles with the idea of abolishing slavery from the outset.
Bringing this to the present day, how are the different peoples that you're talking about, Latinx, African Americans, and Native Americans, how are they faring in Trump's America, especially with the coronavirus?
Great question, right? I mean, we're not faring well. Latinos and African Americans and working class white folk are faring the worst. We don't have adequate resources in our communities to this day. We don't have adequate medical resources. We don't have adequate educational resources to deal with these problems. Many of us live in communities that have absolutely no medical infrastructure. That's not a mistake. That is conditioned by history. What we do have a lot of resources in, I hate the term under-resourced communities because the town I grew up in as a Chicana working class kid, you could say we were under-resourced, but I'll tell you one resource we had plenty of, cops, police, surveillance. I grew up in, actually now I live in Alachua County, which has been judged and studied by organizations like, say, the United Way, who have said this is the most unequal county in the state of Florida in terms of the allocation of resources, which is true. However, again, there's plenty of resources when it comes to the cops, when it comes to the police. We have a military armored car in my community. We have that the police operate. We have police helicopters, right? We have this high-tech gear when our schools are profoundly underfunded. So we're not doing well in Trump's America, but what I do want to emphasize is we weren't really doing that well on the eve of the pandemic virus either. The latest statistics I saw from mainstream resources suggested that there were about 50 million people living in poverty in the United States. I mean, think about that for a minute, 50 million, and that's before the pandemic. Yeah, I mean, it's a double, triple kind of crisis that's really come crashing down on our...
Recently, I spoke to an old friend who happens to now be State Representative Jonathan Santiago, who represents the south end of the 9th Suffolk District in Boston. He's also an ER doctor in Boston who worked closely with Black and Latinx COVID-19 patients at the outset of the pandemic. And what he says goes directly to what you're speaking about. He says, you know, the increased COVID rates among Black and Latino communities, Latinx communities, was not surprising to health professionals. It's really an exacerbation of the disparities that already exist. And he was looking at the issue of the effect of housing protection, the living wage, what's happening economically and educationally, and educational equity-oriented things. I'm talking about equity-oriented legislation. Talk about the issue, particularly now, of the Latinx community as workers, whether it's migrant workers, immigrant workers, undocumented workers, workers from Puerto Rico who live in a colonial status. So how are we to understand now what is happening in terms of the economics to people from the various Latinx communities, and of course those who are forced to leave their homelands to many extent, not just of fear of violence, but terrifying economic conditions from Guatemala, from Mexico, from Honduras, from El Salvador. I know that's, again, a big picture. So how do we look at the Latinx communities as workers and what's happening to them now?
We are working class people. You know, talking about Mexicanos, Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, brothers and sisters from the DR, you know, where we are predominantly working class people. In all of our diversity, in the different languages we speak, in our different cultural or religious practices, that's the commonality. We have been predominantly working class people. We will continue to be predominantly working class people. Even terms like immigration, I want to challenge all of our listeners today, to think about what that even means in a working class context. Brother Juan Gonzalez has written a wonderful book, which I take tremendous inspiration from, and the book is called Harvest of Empire. He was active in the Young Lords in the 60s and early 70s. I would highly lift up that book for your listeners who are trying to get a handle on this larger question. Why do we come to this country to begin with? Because that's implicit in your question. I want to start with that question because it's a family story for me. So my grandparents fought in the Mexican Revolution. Prior to that, they'd actually fought against the Europeans during the colonial period. But, you know, fast forward to 1914, all of my grandparents, from what I know from family history, male or female, fought in the Revolution. It's one of the bloodiest revolutions of the 20th century. Over 1.5 million people are killed, many more displaced. My family picks up and leaves one night in 1914. We're still trying to get more details about that trauma. It was a very traumatic experience of literally fleeing their homeland, coming to the United States. But the same week they left, the U.S. Marines had invaded and occupied oil fields around Tampico through Veracruz, through the port, right? I began to understand as a younger person, younger historian, the connection between U.S. military incursion, U.S. economic policies, U.S. political policies, and again, what Juan Gonzalez refers to as the harvest of empire. It was no mistake that my family fled as refugees, not immigrants, really. They were refugees because of U.S. military occupation of a big part of Mexico. Now, later, I was actually a soldier. I was a soldier of empire in the mid-80s. And I was actually, I did spend time in the Panama Canal Zone in the mid-1980s. Now, this is before the coup. In special forces going throughout the entire region, I saw very clearly that U.S. foreign and military policies were pushing many people in Central America, in Guatemala, Honduras, and other countries, out of their home countries, out of their hometowns, because the U.S. was really lighting it up in terms of providing ammunition, providing weapons, providing military training. That's what I was doing, frankly, being involved in military training. And so that the stoking of the civil wars by the United States was one of the major forces pushing people out of Central America into the United States. So when I got out of the military and I came back to the United States in 1987, you know, I have friends and people ask me, well, Paul, you were down there, meaning Central America. Why are so many Hondurans in Los Angeles or Sacramento or Seattle? You know, why are so many of these people from Venezuela coming up here? You know, and I would say, do you not know what your country is doing in Central America right now to provoke these civil wars? You don't know that this is happening? And they would say, oh, well, you know, I don't want to hear about that, Paul. And I would say, well, I'm going to tell you because I was there, I was involved in it. And so, yes, it's more than just immigration or push-pull factors. You know, we talk about it in academic terms. It's the impact of U.S. foreign policy, military policy, the militarization of the border between the U.S. and Mexico, has spurred violence in northern Mexico. And so is it surprising that a lot of people leave northern Mexico to go to the United States? No, not surprising whatsoever. And that's where, Mimi, I wanted to get us to think about the connections between politics here and politics abroad, foreign policy, internationalism. That's another important part of our traditions as Latinx and Black peoples. When we talk about politics and issues like citizenship, we're not talking about one country, right? We're talking about our home countries, but also countries that we're trying to help promote freedom struggles in.
Your message to our community of listeners about the communities that you have covered in your books, which a must read for our listeners. You place things in an international context, in an anti-colonial context, which has everything to do with the origin of this country. So we now have a displaced labor force that has come here and contributes mightily to the wealth that exists for this country and certainly is generally unable to extract equally or any part of that wealth and suffers terrifyingly disparate treatment. So your message to us as we see our sisters and brothers from the Latinx community going through the terrifying indignity and terror campaigns from ICE, from militias, from the president of vapid and rabid xenophobia.
Exactly. Well, and the terror and horror and the torture and the police brutality, these are again rooted in the history of the colonization and European settler colonialism of this entire hemisphere. But I want to get at something you said earlier, Mimi, which is that, you know, we're essentially displaced workers. And it's important to understand that because that's really the centerpiece of the entire U.S. history. It's really a history of displaced workers. Unfortunately, scholars have been complicit in creating this idea of the middle-class nation. That's a false image, by the way. The U.S. has never been a middle-class nation. It always has been, as you say, a nation of displaced workers. Social movements have been at the center of our efforts to grapple with the perennial crises that we deal with, right? And that's why I became a labor historian, because when I got back to the United States in 87 and I started realizing my country was fundamentally a corrupt nation, I began to ask myself, well, how do we get out of this mess? And so I ended up joining the United Farm Workers Union as an organizer. I worked on an 8-year campaign to help organize farm workers in the Chateau Saint Michel vineyard. You know, many of your listeners participated in that boycott, and I'm very grateful, and I just want to send a thank you and a shout out, because we won that struggle. We won a union contract for the farm workers in the Saint Michel vineyards in 1995. That contract is still in force, by way. And so what it's meant is pensions for predominantly Mexican-American farm workers. They've had the ability to buy homes, they've had the ability to send their kids to college. But the reason I bring up the farm worker struggle and organizing and social movements is that that's the best way we've been able to grapple with this extended crisis of being displaced workers who are subjected to state terror. In the book, you know, in African American Latinx History of the United States, but also in the earlier works like Emancipation Betrayed, I talk about the struggles of Black and brown peoples to organize, whether it's a union or a church or a community-based coalition or even an electoral coalition. That's been our only hope, because we don't individually have the power to do much except for sometimes to take care of our own families, and sometimes not even that. That's why organization and organizing and social movements are so important. It's the last thing that will be taught in schools. Like I do a lot of labor organizing workshops. I work with adults in unions. Some of them are first generation immigrants, and they'll say, why weren't we taught this in our schools? Why weren't we taught how to organize in our schools? You know, and my University of Florida students will say the same thing, right? They'll say, why weren't we taught anything about the civil rights movement or Cesar Chavez or anything like that in high school? And my response is, no self-respecting government is going to teach you how to overthrow it in its own public school system. You know, that's something you've got to learn on your own or from your elders, right? I love the metaphor displaced labor force because, see, that's been U.S. history from the beginning. Think about the first generations of enslaved African workers on those slave ships on the horrific Middle Passage. In a certain dimension, they're also displaced workers, right? Forced through terror to work in the Americas. Think about the Mexican migrants who come up into the U.S. in the 1920s, stopped at the border, sprayed with these terrible pesticides, subjected to grisly human experiments, right? Displaced workers. Think of generations of Puerto Rican workers who were forced out of the country because of Operation Bootstrap. Displaced workers. So there's a continuity of displacement, right, of trauma. And that's certainly my family's history as well. But there's also this equally important history of struggle, of social movements. Even for us in Florida, you know, looking at a politician like, you know, say AOC and what she's done in the Bronx or the Queens, or remembering Shirley Chisholm, Unbossed and Unbought. It's so inspiring. And the last time I was in the Bed-Stuy area, I know I'm an outsider, everything, but I had a chance to talk actually to some Puerto Rican trade unionists. And they said, you know what? We revere the memory of Shirley Chisholm. She was such an incredible speaker, you know, for the rights of Puerto Rican workers, of veterans, of, again, this group of displaced workers that we're talking about. Unbossed and Unbought is one of the great phrases in my mind politically in American history.
In terms of the politicians that you're talking about, in terms of what's happening today, I agree, obviously, that the role of the trade unions and people organizing in trade unions is key. But what should be the role of the federal and state governments in terms of police violence, in terms of income inequalities, especially for Latinx and African American communities?
The role is to make it right. The role should be, we should be talking about reparations in the form of federal and state governments finally acknowledging. Now, we're getting a little bit of it with the Black Lives Matter movement, but remember, again, it's taken a social movement to bring this issue of income inequality into large public discourse. We have the Fight for 15 and union movement. We have a lot of workers, even in high tech, who are turning towards a new kind of union organizing model. But I think we should be demanding that the federal government acknowledge its role in crimes like settler colonialism, in the crime of white supremacy, and making reparations. And let me explain what I mean by that. Mimi, you mentioned my earlier book, Emancipation Betrayed, which is really a book focused on the Black freedom struggle in Florida. So this is the 100th anniversary of the 1920 election campaign. And what that means in Florida is that in the months leading up to the 1920 election, tens of thousands of African Americans, primarily working class people, organized to register and pay their poll taxes to vote. It's a remarkable statewide campaign. It makes the national news. The NAACP uses it to build their base. And what happens on Election Day a century ago is that Black Floridians are brutalized by the state, by county sheriffs, chiefs of police, mayors, chambers of commerce, and the state comes together to crush that organizing campaign. The federal government plays its role by refusing to enforce the U.S. Constitution in the state of Florida. The Constitution says, if you look at the 14th and 15th Amendment, if a state openly suppresses citizenship rights, that state will lose, should lose, congressional representation. And the mechanism for that is the census. 1920 was the census year, just like 2000. So my question to the state of Florida is, what are you going to do to make things right? Because you actively engaged in the suppression of citizenship rights. What do we say to, you know, say to the state of New York? What are you going to do to make it right after the fact that you enforced slavery for generations? What are you going to do to make it right after the fact that you enforced unequal housing conditions, redlining, blockbusting? You can blame realtors for blockbusting or redlining, but in reality, it's the states that actually allow that form of oppression to exist. I say the discussion begins with police budgets how can any municipality, how can a state justify these bloated police budgets in a time when we're looking at economic crisis? I mean, I don't understand what the holdup is. I know we've been fighting in the Deep South, but I'm like, begin by cutting, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, 40% of your local police budget. Use that money for actually productive things, right? That should be, I think, part of the equation in what the federal and state governments can do at this, at this point. But also foreign policy. Let's not forget foreign policy. Make the government defund the Pentagon. You know, if you look at a writer like Junot Diaz, he'll tell you very frankly that a lot of people from the Dominican Republic, a lot of immigrants, are here because the U.S. invaded the country in 1964 and 65 to stop a people's revolution in the Dominican Republic. The entire 82nd Airborne Division, which I actually later served in the 80s, was deployed to this one small country to crush democracy. So make it right now. There's no statute of limitations for, like, human rights and social justice. My suspicion, though, is that you're not going to get the U.S. to go back and make reparations for what we did in 1965 in the Dominican Republic. But what you can say now is, why don't we cut the Pentagon budget? My gosh, how can they even justify having a $700 billion-plus budget in a time of economic crisis? Let's cut it and redistribute the resources.
Well, for sure. We have been speaking, and there will be many more conversations to come with Paul Ortiz, a historian, professor of history at the University of Florida, director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. And I, again, encourage people to read his epic work. He is the author of North American History from a Latinx and African American Perspective. It recasts the narrative. It tells the truth. Truth teller Paul Ortiz, thank you so much for being with us. I truly appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Mimi and Ken.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.